The Public Safety Finance Division will come to order. Members, today we're going to finish up the review of the budget of the Department of Public Safety. And just a couple of announcements. On Thursday, we'll finish our last budget hearing with the Board of Judicial Standards. And we'll start hearing some bills. We don't have a lot of bills referred to this committee, probably because we don't have a lot of money, but we'll be hearing some bills. And we are planning a day to, we haven't totally fleshed it out, but Ms. McMahon's going to be working it out with DPS to OJP, actually. We'd like to have one hearing on the stimulus package and how those dollars, how we might use some of those dollars. It's one-time funding, but it can certainly fill some gaps, I think, in our committee. So we'll keep you posted about that. Okay, then I would need a motion to approve the minutes, since we do have a quorum for March 5th.
So moved, sir.
Representative Reinhart moves the minutes of March 5th. Is there any discussion on those minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Commissioner Campion, I don't know. Oh, Commissioner? Well, we're almost done here, I think. And Deputy Commissioner Ellison, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think we were almost through your PowerPoint presentation, so I don't know if you want to just start up again or how you want to do this. Or
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Mary Ellison, Deputy Commissioner. What we would like to do is to have Superintendent O'Malley go through the last two slides. We had two slides left on the BPA,
okay.
So we thought we would go through the last two slides and then get to the questions that you posed. You have a copy of all of the slides on the BPA just for continuity's sake, but since we were almost finished, we thought we'd just start where we left off and go from there.
Okay, can I just, where's Erica? Erica, can you turn that volume up? Having a hard, I can't hear you very well. Maybe it's just because we're in a new room or something. Okay.
Mr. Chair, is that better?
We could shout if you'd like.
That's better. It could be my old ears, but go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim O'Malley. I'm the superintendent at the BCA. We left off, we left off with the beginning of the forensic service, forensic science lab area, and there's two slides left in the presentation. I think they were handed out as handouts rather than on overhead. Going through the lab quickly again, trying to cover some of the goals that we've established, some of the accomplishments, some of the performance measures. Minnesota is fortunate to have housed at the BCA one of the finest labs in the country, if not the world. There's an awful lot of attention that's paid to turnaround time, which is meritorious, but there are an awful lot of other factors that go into that, influencing factors on turnaround time and in turn justice. The number of submissions that we receive, the number of scientists that we have, forensic advancements, and then separate from that, technological advancements, in particular robotics that I'll mention in a minute, some court rulings and certainly business practices within the law enforcement community and the prosecutorial and defense bar. The National Academy of Sciences just in the last week issued a report that critiqued forensic science analysis throughout the United States. For criminal justice purposes. A number of their conclusions are ones that we've been addressing for a few years now, and in fact the last two sessions of reports provided to this committee, the dealing with funding and turnaround time and the value of forensics, the importance of independence in forensics, and neutrality and so on, quality assurance. And some of those issues will be addressed here this morning then. One of those is accreditation that they talked about. We are, the BCA lab is accredited by the ASCLAD, which is the Association of Crime Lab Directors, their laboratory division. Our current lab director is a past president of ASCLAD. We have scientists who have been trained by them to travel to other laboratories around the world, literally, and do examinations there, which proves beneficial to us to see the latest techniques and to stay up on things. That is the premier accreditation in the world. Second from that, another broader issue is in the last year, in fact, completed in November of 2008, we had an independent assessment come in, an assessor by the Applied Biosystems Corporation paid for a former lab director from down south to come in and do a pretty detailed, very detailed analysis of our DNA section, and came to the conclusions that many of the current practices we have were validated, and some of our there was support for some of the plans we have for improvement that I'll go through now. One of the areas where there's been some improvement, and one of our goals was to increase the use of robotics, in particular in DNA. We have now done that in the last 2 years. Robotics are used to examine known samples. So when there's someone who's been convicted of a crime and we get the sample, we use robotics to do that testing. In cases in which we have a sample left at a crime scene and we need to do elimination or even suspect samples, we'll get a known sample from somebody. We'll swab their mouth. Maybe it's somebody who lives in the house who's a victim, or maybe it's a suspect. Those known samples can be run much more quickly by using robotics, and that's what we've done. There's, as I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of talk about turnaround time. Those known samples, 4 years ago, there was a one-year backlog on those. 4 years ago, when we had a known sample come in, it would take up to a year to know the DNA profile on that. Today, as I sit here, 95% of those are done in less than 2 weeks. All of them are done in less than 30 days. And that's because of the advancements in robotics and some other changes that we've done. A pilot program in the area of narcotics. We have two pilot programs going right now. One is a preliminary testing of drugs. We've done this in Stearns, Benton, and Freeborn counties in association with the law enforcement and the prosecutorial entities there. And what we do is we'll get the drugs from them. They're brought into the lab. We guarantee them we will get them an analysis back within 2 weeks that will include the weight and a preliminary analysis on the type of drug it is. They then use that in agreement with the prosecutors and the defense bar and the courts for charging purposes and often to get through the omnibus or evidentiary hearing. In narcotics cases, I don't know the exact percent, but I'm sure well over 95% of the cases are settled after the evidentiary hearing. It's often not a question of whether they're drugs. It's a question of whether they were seized lawfully or if the statement was taken lawfully, those kinds of issues. So once that's done, most often the cases are resolved. As a result, in those three counties, we are doing we're only doing 20% of the full tests that we used to do. That's saving us an awful lot of time. We're looking to expand that to other counties next. A second pilot program is rather than have the drugs come into the lab at all, in Olmsted County, we have provided law enforcement down there with equipment to do a preliminary test themselves that their prosecutor and their courts have agreed would be sufficient for charging purposes and to get through the evidentiary hearing. That equipment was down there for a year. We just brought it back to the BCA to do some more validation testing on it. We have done some random samples on that and found that the preliminary test by this machine has so far been 100% accurate. When we do the full-blown test, it takes a lot more time. So those are a couple of the things that we're doing to move it forward. Another pilot to save some time is the video conferencing. We're doing that with Murray County and Clay County. And that gets to Fifth and Sixth Amendment issues sometimes on the ability to have counsel present and also the ability to confront your witnesses. But fairly often, laboratory testimony, especially just the report to get that in, is literally less than a minute. They sit there, is this your report? Yes. Did you follow procedures? Yes. And if there's no questions, then the report gets in and it's admitted. So we've worked something out in those couple of counties in which the scientists, rather than drive to 4 or 5 or 6 hours or maybe even spend the night somewhere and be away from the bench that long, they can walk down the hall at the BCA, go into a conference room, we put them on a TV, they do their testimony that way, and the evidence gets admitted, and they walk back and they're working on the bench within 15 minutes. Again, that's a pilot that's worked very well in those couple of counties, and we're trying to work, in fact, the commissioner sits on a committee of a wide group of people in criminal justice looking for new ideas and ways to do this, and the Supreme Court is on that committee, and they're examining this in terms of the constitutionality. We have the latest software at the BCA for quality protocols. That's in place, and that's one of the things that the independent assessor was complimentary about. That, as I mentioned, turnaround time is awful important. It gets a lot of attention. But if the tests aren't done right, if you don't get the right results, you never, ever would cut a corner or sacrifice quality in order to get it done faster. So we have now some software in place that helps automate that to make sure that whenever there's anything that might be out of whack, it gets that second look that it needs to get. A couple of partnerships that are noteworthy. One is with the Minneapolis Police Department. Last year, we entered into an agreement with the city of Minneapolis in which they pay the salaries of two BCA scientists. They are state employees, but they work, their priorities are to work on Minneapolis cases initially. The advantage to the state is that some of those cases are going to be worked by us anyway, but they get to set their priorities to meet local needs a little bit more. In particular, in DNA, they're doing it for some property crimes that would normally take a little bit longer, but instead they're doing that, the quality of life type crimes that are having an impact in Minneapolis. I've talked to their deputy chief in the last week, and they are extremely pleased with the results of this, to the point where now we're entering into the agreement where we're going to double that. We're going to have four scientists paid for by the city of Minneapolis. We've offered that to a number of other law enforcement agencies if they want to do that. Again, it's to help prioritize at the local level, but it also results in us somewhere in 80 to 85% of their time will be spent on those cases. But some of their time is also spent on peer review. We need that part of the quality assurance so that it is a benefit to all 87 counties by doing this.
Superintendent, can I ask you a question about that? I think that it's a good idea. And certainly Minneapolis has its share of crime problems. I'm thinking my city does too. And so are we moving in that direction where cities with higher rates of crime will have to rely on local property taxes to fund scientists in order to get lab results in a quicker manner?
We are making that, Mr. Chair, we are making that option available to any law enforcement agency. We have never turned down a case, and we never will. It's a matter of turnaround time. And if they want to set at a higher priority on some property crimes, and I've talked to Chief Harrington about this, and he's looking at his budget to see whether he might want to do that too. And I've met with him and Chief Dolan about how this is working.
I get it, but I'm just wondering if this is a good, if this is the practice that we can, with declining state funds, are we going to be relying more on property taxes to do lab work? Local property taxes, and if my department wants results faster, are we going to have to pay more?
Chair, I guess I would defer to this committee as to how the resources should be allocated. I do have an opinion on that, and it's, some of it's represented in the report that was given to you, I think. But I will tell you this, Mr. Chair, that we can house 40 more scientists at the BCA tomorrow.
Well, why don't you finish? Because I have some more questions about the scientist level. How many scientists did we provide last biennium? 13? 13?
Provided $1.92 million over the biennium, and we have increased our scientists' complement by 8. The second partnership I want to mention is with the FBI. We have an agreement with them that's been in place for a few years now for mitochondrial DNA scientists. They pay for 9 positions at the BCA, and it's similar to our arrangement with Minneapolis. 3/4 of their time is spent on federal cases that are brought to the BCA from anywhere around the country, and 25% of their time can be spent on state BCA or state of Minnesota cases. Just a couple of quick stats then. Our caseloads, as testified before, has increased significantly in the last several years. From 2002 to 2008, it's gone up about 42%. And in the last, and that's in within the sections, and in the last 2 years, it's gone up about 8%. And then our turnaround time, in 2005, 54% of all cases were done within 30 days. In 2008, 60% were done within 30 days. The alcohol cases, which make up about a third of the cases in the lab, are always done within 30 days. So in a way, those figures are a little bit misleading, but if you remove the alcohol cases, that really gets to the heart of all the other cases in the lab. In that case, in 06, 20% of cases were done within 30 days. And in 08, 30% of the cases are done within 30 days. So there's been some improvement. So the DNA, drug, latent prints, and so on, that's going a little bit better. And then to address your question earlier, Mr. Chair, the money, the $1.9 million has been used entirely for scientists' salaries and costs. Offsetting that a little bit is we've had some rising costs, clearly, with the Hay study that was implemented last year, and insurance and some other costs. So that's where that money is going, along with some pretty hardy market competition for our sciences.
Superintendent, so if on page 41 of the budget book, so it's the FTEs there. How many actual scientists do you have? Or am I looking at the right?
I have a moment to find the page, sir. Yeah, Mr. Chair, the numbers by bottom is the full-time equivalents for the entire lab, so it's been around 100. Scientists, I believe we're... I have that number here, and I could get it for you exactly, but I believe we're at about 60, 68, and with the new ones, we might be in the range of 76 in the past year.
And you say you would need how many? I mean, how many did you say? I forgot what you just said earlier that you could use.
Well, we have room in the BCA lab. When that building was built over 5 years ago, it was built with the idea of expansion in mind. And between Bemidji and our headquarters building, we could utilize up to 40 more scientists without having to do any further construction or more equipment or anything like that.
Well, Superintendent, how many do you actually? How many would be the right number to adequately meet your goals for turnaround time for the lab? What would be the ideal number if you're 76 now?
Mr. Chair, I'm hesitating because it's not as simple a question as, I mean, I'll tell you, we could have 110 or so. Would that get us to 30 days for all cases? I'm not certain about that because of advancements in robotics and this video conferencing. Some of those kinds of things are going to play a big role in this, along with the advancements in science. We are prepared to do more with DNA, and there's other areas around the country that are, and we could do that, and that would, I think, have a great effect on public safety. But without any further capital cost, we could easily have 110, 115 scientists in the lab, and that would make a big difference, along with the other factors I mentioned that affect turnaround time.
Senator Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this may be a question for Chair Hillstrom's committee, but I was wondering, when you set your goals, what measurements do you use? Is there, just kind of like a national standard, or I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, because there's no doubt there's obviously been an improvement, and that is good progress, but I was just wondering for this general thought process, is there a general standard you use to set those measurements and goals?
Superintendent O'Malley.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't know of a national standard. We have compared ourselves with some other states, and we compare favorably in terms of turnaround time. Turnaround time is an issue everywhere in the world, but certainly everywhere in the United States. A couple of years ago, there was a study put together by the legislature, and that group set as a standard a goal of 30 days for a turnaround time. They thought that would be a reasonable goal to try to achieve that would reasonably have a positive effect on criminal justice. It really isn't necessary to turn it around in 24 hours. On the other hand, 180 days may be too much, but it's also a case by case. There are times when we will get some evidence in, and it may take 90 days to analyze that evidence and get the result back, and that will have absolutely no effect on public safety. That's fine. The person's in custody. There may be a number of other reasons. Other times, when we have an unknown suspect on a serial rapist case, we'll turn that around in 48 hours, 72 hours, as quickly as we possibly can, have scientists come in on the weekend. So we try to balance all that. So the simple 30-day number can be a little misleading, but that's the goal that was set by the legislature a few years back.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent, maybe I'm not remembering this right, but I think that I remember in previous years there's kind of an issue with training in scientists. Is that an issue in turnaround? I should say the length that of time that we could benefit by having somebody stay so we could train them and then get some good use out of that training. I guess, could you speak to that? Is that an issue? Is turnover in this field an issue?
Superintendent?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, it is. It's a very important issue in this arena. It can take anywhere from 6 months to 2 years to train a scientist, even an experienced scientist, to be able to operate independently of lab, in the lab, to meet our accreditation and quality assurance standards. The mitochondrial DNA section, for example, when we started that a few years ago, our scientists, who are already, some of them already working DNA, nuclear DNA, spent 18 months in training before they worked their first case alone in the BCA lab in order to get accredited. Last year, when the Forensic Laboratory Advisory Board report came out, they listed 7 items that were critical for the future of forensic laboratory science in Minnesota. One of those was compensation parity. And while we can't force other labs to pay certain salaries, one of the recommendations was that at least publicly funded labs, we should try to have a level of parity so that we don't steal from each other. That has not been very successful in the last year. There are other publicly funded labs who have hired BCA scientists who are well trained, and now we are in the process of replacing them. And again, that puts us maybe anywhere from 6 to 24 months behind.
So that, Mr. Chair and the Superintendent, so that could be a significant factor in the turnaround time that we're talking about as well, too. It's just because we aren't, our scientists aren't operating at 100% of efficiency. Is that a fair thing to say? And I guess the question is, if we would hire more, how does that play into that problem? Are there more out there that are available? Is it difficult to find quality people? Would we be just filling in slots and then just creating a faster turnaround? How does this issue play into the idea of being more productive?
Superintendent?
Mr. Chair and members, it isn't as dire as it may sound from my last couple of statements. It's a concern. It's a large concern. We have lost, to put it in perspective, we have had 6 scientists in the last year leave to go to work for other publicly funded laboratories. Most of them are between 4 and 12 years of experience, hitting their prime, bearing in mind that their first 2 years, they're not only not productive, they actually drain the lab a little because we have experienced scientists training them. To offset that, the Hay study that was done last year has now been implemented. That puts our salary closer and our benefits closer to the other laboratories, which is very good. We're also working with the Attorney General's office on kind of comparable to a non-compete clause, that if they're going to be hired by the BCA, if they leave within a certain number of years, they have to reimburse us for the training they receive. It is beneficial to the state of Minnesota to have highly qualified and well-trained scientists. We can't hire them and put them to work in 30 days. So it is a long-term investment, and we're taking a number of steps to try and level that playing field. There are other aspects of the BCA, our reputation, quite literally internationally. We have people who have come from other countries and have come from other states to see how we do things and work with that. And scientists, as anybody in public service, they're not all in it for the money. They're in it to do some good things. And that's a distinction that I think the BCA offers, and that's something we're working to enhance.
Do you have more that you would in your presentation, Superintendent?
I do, to move on to Mingus next, if we're done with the last one. The Minnesota Justice Information section of the BCA is the third of the 3 main sections. One was investigations in the laboratory, and now Mingus. One of the bigger events in this section was a reorganization that took place in the past year. We went from really sort of a function-oriented to a service-oriented approach, if you will. It has allowed for a portfolio process where all new projects coming in and our continuation of some of the information technology projects we have are accepted, evaluated, and set on a schedule. It's prioritized, and it's much more responsive to all in criminal justice. In particular, we've gotten input from the task force and the policy groups that provide that input to us. A couple of real specific areas that I'll just mention quickly. One is the new APIS system, the Automated Fingerprint Identification System. This is was implemented in the past year, was purchased and implemented as part of a partnership with St. Louis County Sheriff's Department, and then also North Dakota and South Dakota. Over 2 million fingerprints have been converted in the past year from the old system to the new system now, and it's fully operational. To highlight a couple of the advantages of this, 8 years ago or so, there were about 60,000 fingerprint cards, inked fingerprint cards that most have seen that were mailed into the BCA. When someone gets arrested or booked into a facility, they get sent into the BCA. On average, it would take about 6 weeks to get back to that law enforcement agency or that correctional facility to tell them to a biometric certainty who it is that they were talking to or who it is that they just booked. People can give whatever name and date of birth and aliases and so on they want, but it would take 6 weeks. Today, as we sit here, last year we received about 163,000 fingerprints, sets of fingerprints into the BCA. Well over 98% of those were electronically submitted. This is what this APHIS will permit us to do, and the live scans that go along with it. And the average time to get back to that entity, whether it's a police department, sheriff's department, or correctional facility, and tell them who it is that's standing next to them that they just fingerprinted, is 3.5 minutes. You can imagine all the different scenarios to know for sure who it is that's there, whether there's a warrant form out of another state, or whether their fingerprints, maybe this is the first time they've ever been arrested, but they left a fingerprint at a sexual assault in Mankato in 1993. Well, now we can match that while they're still there rather than give them a six-week head start. A second issue is the rapid identification devices related to this. These are devices that are put out in the squad cars. We deployed in the past year an additional 125 of those, so now there are 350 of those in the streets in Minnesota, and what they are is two-finger IDs. So when somebody gets stopped, they maybe don't have identification on them. You have some reasonable suspicion or probable cause to detain them. You don't know who they are. You can put the two fingers in there, and again, within a matter of minutes, you'll get something back if they're in the database, telling you exactly who they are and whether there's a warrant or anything like that for them. You don't have to drive down to the law enforcement center. You can also clear innocent people and get them on their way so the cops stay on the street longer and are more productive with their time. Cybers, another one that's been worked on for a while now is the comprehensive incident-based record system. There's been tremendous progress in that in the past year. A year ago, there was one law enforcement agency that was a participant in cybers. Today, there are 86 law enforcement agencies who are submitting information and retrieving information out of this comprehensive record database system. There are 10,000 records were in it at the beginning of the year. Now there are 46,000 entries in there, and we are averaging over 1,000 entries a week that are going into there. 8 of the 9 vendors who have built the interface, who are certified in order to provide the service, 8 of those 9 are done completely with their work, and they are working with up to another 100 or more law enforcement agencies right now to try and get that done. Our hope would be to have at least 150 or more law enforcement agencies active in that by the end of the year. E-charging is another of the, when we pull criminal justice across the board, not just law enforcement, but the courts, prosecutors, law enforcement, defense bar, cybers and e-charging are two of the highest priorities they have set for us to work on. E-charging has now been designed, tested, and it's being piloted in Olmsted, Kandy, Ojai, Carver, and St. Louis counties. What e-charging does is it turns us into a paperless charging system, basically. So a police officer would go back, type up reports, get them in the computer, hit a send button, it would go to the prosecutor's office, no paper's been generated, nobody has to get in their car and drive anywhere. Prosecutor would review that, draft up a complaint, send that complaint back to the officer would sign it electronically. We have it so that the officer's fingerprint would go on there, so there's no doubt that this is something that's been reviewed. It then goes to the courts. The courts will then approve it, if it's approvable, and issue a warrant or a summons, and then that will go back to the law enforcement and prosecutors. Nobody's had to leave their office. If the prosecutor feels like reviewing on a Saturday at 2 in the afternoon, or if a judge reviews it at a different time, that's fine. This will save a tremendous amount of time and will help keep law enforcement officers and prosecutors at their desk or on the street where they need to be rather than sitting in a hallway waiting for somebody to review a document in their hand and do that. And then the last couple of quick items that go back a little ways was MREP, the Minnesota Repository of Arrest Photos. If you think back, not too many years ago when somebody got arrested, there was a Polaroid picture taken and it went into a hard file, and if I run a criminal history and I see that somebody was arrested in Winona and I want to look at that photo, somebody's got to drive down to Winona and get it. And that's just how it operated. Today, there are at the end of 06, there were 880,000 digital photos in this system now from around Minnesota. Today, there are 1.3 million of those photos. So I don't care where you're at in Minnesota, if you want to see a photo of somebody who was arrested, you can just pop it up and it's up on your computer instantly, and it saves, obviously, a lot of time. And then the last thing I would mention is the suspense program, the suspense project. criminal history records coming from the courts to go into the BCA criminal history database. Starting at the turn of the century, there were fully up to 50% of those records would go into suspense, meaning that there was some reason that the conviction record didn't match the arrest record. Could be fingerprints, could be an SID number that's been messed up, could be the spelling of the name, whatever it might be. The goal we set there was to get that down to 10%. It's now at 11.5%, and obviously a lot of progress has been made in the last few years on that. The last thing I would mention regarding the budget is just as a reminder, I guess, that in last session for fiscal year 09, the integration project area within MNJIS had its budget reduced $1.265 million, and the tails on that carried through to 10 and 11. So that's a cut that we're already dealing with and have plans for.
Thank you, Superintendent. Representative Plunge. Yes.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. O'Malley, on that same vein of e-charging, is there any pilot projects going on with, like, the troopers or anyone else as far as tickets in the squad cars? Because right now there's a lot of departments that they're still under that old paper system. We write a ticket, and one copy stays with us, one goes to the law enforcement center, and we run into a problem with them getting lost or stuck on the bottom of something, and all of a sudden the courts don't have them. They call down to the LEC, the law enforcement center, and find out where they are. Is anybody trying a system where they're, like, the computer in the car spits out a ticket, and then it goes right to the court and misses out the middle person there, so it's on everybody's records at the same time? Or
Mr. Chairman, members, there's a project that's going on with that. It's not done yet, and I think the commissioner could address it at a broader level, or Dave Johnson, who is the executive director of CrimNet, is here, and he would be more familiar with the details of that project.
Mr. Chair, you can just get back to me afterwards and save the time now, and maybe I can talk with Dave.
Superintendent, just maybe I missed something in your presentation. So the is phase two of the e-charging project, is it complete then? I have there's a contract here that I'm just curious. Look, it's Intertech Incorporated that got $1 million and a contract for phase two of e-charging. I'm assuming is that done now?
I think we're done with phase one and just starting on phase two. Again, I could have more detail if you'd like.
Okay. And will that be done then, phase two? Or is there another phase to it?
Come on up. You okay, Mr. Chair? I'd have Dave Johnson address that question.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is David Johnson. I'm the Executive Director for MNJIS Minnesota Justice Information Systems. And phase two of the e-charging project is just starting. It will commence in the Virginia Courthouse on the 18th of March. It will then run for approximately 6 months, and that will then end phase two. And phase three will then be an evaluation of lessons learned, issues encountered in phase two, and then phase three involves a statewide rollout of e-charging.
Mr. Johnson, so the $1 million contract to Intertech, will there be another contract, or is that for all three phases of the project?
Mr. Chair and members, that is for phase two. If it goes beyond that, there would then need to be funding and another contract for services with Intertech.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, I was just wondering what the update and status is on CrimNet. I know with funds being tight, it's, you know, kind of difficult to kind of go full force with it. But I was just wondering if you had an update. I don't think it was been about a year and a half or so since we've had a pretty broad discussion about it. Want an update?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair and members, CrimNet is still functioning. Again, as Superintendent O'Malley has indicated, the CrimNet program office and those functions and responsibilities, along with those traditional functions and responsibilities of what was known as CJIS, Criminal Justice Information Systems, were rolled into one organization effective the 1st of August of 2008. And so now I have the responsibility over both of those enterprises. We have a governance team model, and we're moving forward on our core priority projects. Our three core priority projects are e-charging, name event index service, and cybers. Those are all moving forward. We have 16 other projects that are currently being worked on in various phases, and a significant number of them that are in the parking lot. And again, our ability to continue to move forward on all those projects is highly dependent upon future resources.
And Mr. Johnson, when I look at this contract list that DPS provided us, so when I see CJIS staff augmentation, what is that?
Mr. Chair and members, that is from what was then the Criminal Justice Information System, and it is to provide technical services and expertise to augment our current staff that are state employees.
So, Mr. Johnson, I see integration architects and the Marco Group, I mean, literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. That's how much, what are we getting for all of that staff augmentation?
Mr. Chair and members, the staff augmentation folks are working on various products and projects that are the responsibility of both the old CJIS and the CRIMNET program office. As a general rule, some of them are associated directly with the production of a particular product, the rollout of a product. That would be exemplified by those associated with Intertech. They are associated, again, with the name event index project and with e-charging. Many of those other staff augmentation contractors are associated with a myriad of projects and product support, and they represent skills that we currently do not have within the framework of our staff that are necessary to do that work.
So just so I'm clear, so these are companies that are providing technical assistance and training to your technical people to come up to speed on CRIMNET?
Mr. Chair and members, they generally are not providing technical training. There are times in which we do a contract for training-specific purposes, such as for our training for our BEA Aqualogic service. That's the Enterprise Service Bus, which is the service delivery mechanism for our entire enterprise. In that particular contract, that was for training. But the majority of those other contracts are not for training purposes. They are to provide actual work and technical expertise. In other words, doing functions, doing duties, not training other staff.
Okay, thank you. Just members, you know, you should have these sheets in your packet from a while back, but these were the contractors that we requested.
Mr. Chair, if I can mention one other thing related to that.
There are
advantages and disadvantages to contracting versus having a state employee do the work always. This is often a very highly complex area, and we have been able to go into the marketplace and get good value for that dollar to have a level of expertise like in e-charging to develop some of that system that we just didn't have in-house. And at the time that some of these contracts were let, you know, the cost will fluctuate based on the market as it goes. So when the contracts are up, with today's economy, it might be that we can get even better prices in the future with some of these people that are out of work or that contractors. But it also gives us the option that when we go from phase two to phase three, if there's a different type of service, if there's something different in it, then the company provides those services. And the idea is that at some point we won't need that particular detailed expertise once it becomes into the maintenance mode. But there are an awful lot of projects that do require that expertise, and frankly, we can't attract it at state salaries to have that level of expertise for a short period of time.
Representative Eastland has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent, I'm thinking about just as we hear kind of the direction everything is going and kind of the high-tech cyberspace kind of image that we're going in the direction with our law enforcement. Can you just tell us a little bit about what we're doing in the data privacy area? It information about people can get into the system so quickly now and disseminated so fast. What are we doing to protect people's privacy in that environment?
Mr. Chair and members, that's a very, very timely question and issue. The BCA and the Department of Public Safety pulled together a privacy committee about 2 years ago. On that committee was a representative from the ACLU, a media attorney, defense bar, courts, prosecutors, cops, a private citizen advocate that I think everybody in this room knows, and a few others, probably about a dozen people. And the goal really was to put it on the table in front of people with divergent views, but who were genuine about their concerns for both privacy and public safety. This is an age-old debate. It goes back to Queen's Writs 250 years ago that, you know, the British could just stand at your front door and write in your address and go in and do a search. And they said, no, you got to go to a judge now. There's a privacy versus public safety issue here. This is the modern-day issue of that, and technology is advancing very quickly. But there are, I know I call it gaps, but there are areas that need to be addressed and draw that balance. Along those lines, there's a bill that's been submitted this year to create a new classification within the Data Practices Act called Criminal Intelligence Data. And the committee I mentioned, while they might not endorse the exact language of that bill, to a person they would say, this is an issue that we need to bring to the legislature's attention. We need to lay it on the table because there are policy issues that many believe are falling out of sync with technology today.
Representative Hill,
just a quick follow-up.
I just want to, that's fine, but I just, you know, we really need to stick on the budget. And these are sort of policy questions, and this is the last time we're going to have DPS here, but go ahead and ask here.
Yeah, and I realize that this is policy. I guess, so my question is that committee's function is ongoing, and they do serve as a recommendation source for continuing to provide some oversight into this area. From the public's perspective,
Superintendent O'Malley,
Mr. Chair, members, they were put together for a specific purpose of dealing with privacy issues and data collection for the Fusion Center, the Minnesota Joint Analysis Center. But it is a voluntary group, and within the last month, we have contacted all of them again and suggested that we all get together a second time. So yes, we are seeking their input on these things. In fact, I've talked to both Chuck Samuelson and Antonson, the attorney, about this exact issue. I sent them copies of the bill that we're sending in. It's all out in the open. We're going to have the debate and hopefully come to some resolution. Was there one other thing,
Mr. Johnson?
Just for Representative Eastman, Mr. Chair, just so you're aware that every time we work on a new system, it's required that we do a privacy impact assessment, which follows all the data points through the Data Practices Act and discusses those particular issues that you mentioned. And to the extent that those issues become problematic, we have come to the legislature to seek clarification and assignment of a classification, which occurred for cybers, NIST, name event index, and e-charging, all of which went to the legislature because we were creating new pieces of data, and they were classified by the legislature.
Representative Hillstrom is next, and then Zagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With the combining of these two systems, did you have any cost savings within your department? And if not, why not? And both in staff and in rent.
Superintendent, Mr. Johnson.
I can go first. Mr. Chair, members, there was no financial cost savings. What it did is we had at one point, 86 projects that were in the pipeline at any one given point. And when we are in that function-based approach rather than a service-based approach that I mentioned, and by doing that, it wasn't as coordinated as it should have been. It would be comparable to being a contractor for building homes and having all these homes going up at once, but maybe not ever getting one of them done as quickly as you should. There's a better way to organize it. That's what happened from this. So now we have a clearer direction, and our priorities more directly match the priorities set by the task force and the policy group, so that cybers, e-charging, NIST are coordinated and moving forward at the right pace. And there are some other projects, there's no work being done on them. They're clearly in the parking lot, and we tell people that, and until we complete these and we get it in there. So we, as before, we still have much more work than we can do than we have resources. I think that will always be the case in terms of information sharing, at least for the foreseeable future. But we are better organized and more efficient in producing the products than we've ever been.
Thank you, Mr. So are you centrally located now at one place, or do you have folks, you know, in different places, different buildings, renting different space?
Superintendent.
Mr. Chair and members, at one time they were separate. We are now centrally located and under one governance structure. One director oversees all of it, and we have a master scheduler who has authority to determine where the resources, different skills will be addressed on different projects and sets out a timeline for all these projects, phases 1, 2, and 3 and so on, so they move very smoothly.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if they're all centrally located now, there was no savings in rent, or does it just cost more for where you are? I'm just trying to figure that piece out.
Mr. Chair and members, it's been several years since they had an off-site, since CRIM had an off-site. They were in the BCA. They've been moved around within our facility, and we had to make some changes in terms of how people are aligned, but it's the same office, same square footage that we've always had.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On back to the bid sheet that was provided, some of these say single source, no bid, and they're for hundreds of thousands of dollars. I'm just wondering, is there an explanation for what single source? And if you look on the next page, some of them say only bidder. So I knew there was obviously a difference between just one person bidding, but what's the single source, no bid for some of these contracts, like WPV and Unisys?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the designation for single source as a general rule means that that individual entity has such integrated knowledge into a particular subject area or into a particular project that they've been embedded into that project with a goal at the end of it to produce a product that they to switch it to another vendor would be counterproductive. In order to get that single source designation, we have to work within the framework of the Department of Administration, OET, OTSS, and all the other oversight groups to ensure that the requirements for that designation are in fact met. I'll give you an example that we're working on, for instance, e-charging, and we've got, let's say, architect that is working on that project and gets down to the end of the 3 years that they are allowed to be as a contractor to start all over and to put out that set of skills and to take it off at that point in time where the product has reached and to then do that learning curve would cost us more money and be counterproductive to the end result of what we're trying to accomplish. So there are a lot of thresholds that need to be gone through within the framework of the state system in order to get a single source designation.
Thank you, and I appreciate that, but what if, I mean, this has taken years. I mean, what if in the process somebody, has been able to be more expedient on technology or has come up with a more cost-effective way or a more secure way of doing something? I mean, do you not even look at the emerging technologies that have come out, you know, maybe since you started on some of these projects?
Mr. Chair and Representatives, as a general rule, these are not associated with a technology, but associated with the production of a product. That product has been designed and is being worked upon. And therefore, that service that's going towards that is reaching a goal or reaching an endpoint that has been determined. But your point is exactly right, Representative, in that before we go to that elevation of a single source, we challenge ourselves to make sure that that designation is appropriate, that the cost-benefit analysis in doing that comes out with the state as the winner in that, and that we just don't continue that relationship for other than appropriate reasons to make sure that we get to the goal that we need to get to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With these project expansions, you know, we're looking at cutting budgets across, you know, the budget, and you know, sometimes it's what's nice to have versus what's necessary to have. And so are there any projects that you're working on that we would consider just nice to have that really aren't going to save money or efficiencies versus, you know, the need to have or have to have projects that you're working on?
Superintendent O'Malley.
Mr. Chair and members, the core projects that we've described all would increase efficiency and save money in the long run for the criminal justice system.
Mr. Chair, I guess I wasn't expecting that answer because that's a pretty impressive thing. Who's it going to save money for, do you know? I mean, is it just the courts? Is it just you, law enforcement? Who typically?
Superintendent O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll give you e-charging as an example. Current practice is that when a detective finishes their report, they go over and sit with the prosecutor, and often have to wait there for a while, and then they'll leave, and she'll go down to the courthouse and sit outside the signing judge's deal. And I've done it many times. You sit in the hallway for an hour or more till the judge is done with whatever, and then you go in there and they sit there and read it, and you sit there while they read it. That's a lot of wasted time by many people, prosecutors, judges, certainly law enforcement. That time that law enforcement could be on the street at a time when we may have fewer law enforcement officers and we could keep them on the street being productive, that I believe is a pure public safety issue, and that would greatly save the entire criminal justice system in the long run. When I mentioned the APHIS project, for example, that was expensive. The new APHIS project was very expensive. But we did it in partnership with a lot of federal money. We did it in partnership with St. Louis County, North and South Dakota. But to go from 6 weeks to 3.5 minutes to determine who's there, if that person should not be on the street because they're dangerous, and we could keep them behind bars immediately, as opposed to, and even the mailing of the cards. You roll all the way down the line, the cost of postage. We get people that would have to sit there and open these envelopes all day, and now it's all electronic. That has saved tremendous time and has, I believe, tremendously increased public safety across the state. There's a cost to that, clearly. But when you ask, would this improve efficiency and would it increase public safety? Certainly the core projects we've talked about, I wouldn't classify any of them as nice to have. I mean, you could stop doing it. We could go back to the old ways. But we have now been able to identify the real cost of that to society.
Mr. Chair, final question.
Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're looking at this e-charging implementation, phase two, 1 year, correct? And then phase three, how long? Because if this is going to save us lots and lots of money, you know, at a time of budget deficit, we're, you know, looking for every dollar. So timeline for implementation.
But the specific timeline, I'll leave it to Mr. Jones to talk about. But some of these projects, I'm confident they'll be completed someday. They are that valuable. I mean, they just are. And I understand. I have great deference for the difficult position you're in here. But some of them have been delayed already. Some of them we're going to pilot in more counties than we're piloting it in. So it's a matter of that timeline, how far you want to stretch that out. But I leave it to Mr. Johnson to describe the exact timeline right now based on funding as we projected it.
Mr. Chair and representatives, phase two is currently funded. It will run for approximately the next 6 months, in which time we will then evaluate, as I said before, the lessons that we've learned, make adjustments to the product. After that, we will then have a product and the knowledge base to deliver on a statewide basis through working with vendors and building interfaces. The speed and the ability to roll out phase three, defining phase three as a complete rollout on a statewide basis, is predicated totally upon the resources that are available to do that. So I can't give you an exact timeline, Mr. Chair, or members, not knowing what those resources may or may not be.
Mr. Chair, one final statement, not a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the challenges that we have here at the legislature is actually balancing things that cost and things that save money. And so if the argument is that this is going to save all of these other folks money, you can structure a fiscal note so it looks like it costs money in the beginning, but you bank all the savings that you're going to get at the end of the biennium. So I would encourage you to structure this rollout of the deal to bank the money that you're going to save, and then you'll have all the money that you need to implement the program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's hard to follow. Forgive me if I missed this somewhere, but I'm looking at this sheet with the contract, and I see this line for paid media programs for law enforcement. And if we've been through this, I don't want to rehash it, and I'll ask somebody else. But if not, could you just explain briefly what that is, because it is a lot of money. We're on the last page at the very top.
Deputy Commissioner, are you... this must be transportation. This is State Patrol. Transportation related. Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. This is through the Office of Traffic Safety, and we get specified federal funds for media advertising. So when we have saturation for DWI and Ticket or Ticket and those sorts of things, we're able to use that federal money to advertise those programs.
Mr. Levi.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that explanation. So is that all federal money that's designated for that purpose, or is there any general fund money in that?
That's a big question.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is federal fund dollars.
Okay, I have a couple questions. Are you done, Superintendent, or did you...
I'm not quite, Mr. Chair,
okay,
but I'll move very quickly here at the end, if that's right. I mentioned the three divisions within the BCA. Across all divisions now, there are a couple of partnerships and a couple of accomplishments or goals that I wanted to mention. One, at the beginning of 2008, we set a goal of increasing diversity at the BCA through a disabled employee program. We partnered with several nonprofits, with the governor's office, with Doer, and with Deed, tapped into some federal money. We now have three employees at the BCA who are, quote, service workers, one with a mental disability, one who's deaf and partially blind, and the third has autism. When we started on this program a couple years ago, we had the idea it was to tap into an underutilized but highly productive area of the workforce that's underemployed. 20% or so of the quality people who have competencies are not employed. Now, again, with the turn in the economy, there's an awful lot of people looking for jobs, but I still believe that this is something that we've plugged into a resource that will pay off in the long run. Secondly, we have we embarked on a project to assess the state of financial crime investigative efforts within the state of Minnesota. There are federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies who are doing a number of different things. This is clearly a timely law enforcement and criminal justice issue, all the different financial fraud and so on. We completed a study of that, and as a result of that, there's a legislative proposal that's moving forward this year to change the governance structure of the Financial Crime Task Force that I think would result in increased accountability and a better, more comprehensive approach to that crime issue. Thirdly, we have piloted a program, or actually engaged in a program now with the Chief Sheriff and County Attorneys Association, a training program to do internet training. It's something that, rather than have law enforcement travel or prosecutors travel all over to go sit for 4 hours in a classroom, we did it one time. It worked very well, paid for 100 licenses, and sat at the BCA and put this out there, and people could email in the questions. It was unanimously endorsed by people. It cost a chunk of money for us to do it, but it saved, again, local law enforcement paying overtime or per diem or gas to go somewhere. So we are embarked on that still with the executive directors of those three associations to continue with that. One other partnership quickly is the cold case playing cards. Maybe you've heard about. We did that with Department of Corrections, with the Department of Public Safety, media, and the private sector to put these playing cards in every inmate or prisoner's hands in the state of Minnesota. That has resulted in a number of leads, and we're fairly optimistic that in the next week or so you'll see some results from that that cost the state basically nothing. We got private funding to do that. And then lastly, I mentioned a partnership that we've embarked on a couple of years ago, and in the last year it's really taken hold well, working with the tribes both here in Minnesota and in Wisconsin, and with the Wisconsin DCI, our counterpart over there, to combat crimes against children in Indian country. It's a matter of sharing some of our IT expertise to look at ICAC, predatory offenders, Amber Alerts, and some other practical solutions to some of these crimes on reservations. And we are holding a joint conference again with them up at Hinckley this year. It goes back and forth between the states. But a lot of progress has been made with building stronger relationships with the tribal law enforcement and the tribal courts. That's it, sir.
Mr. Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Superintendent O'Malley. Just maybe some historical perspective. We heard a lot about all the technology and efficiencies. You talked about, you know, the fingerprinting 3.5 minutes and someone driving to get pictures. Over the years, then, how has our staffing gone throughout the BCA? Is it a matter that we're just working with so much more criminal activity, or has our staffing gone from doing job A to job B? Could you maybe help on that perspective of what's happened in our staffing with all these efficiencies that technology is giving us?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Superintendent O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, members, it's both of those. It's a matter of with the increased technology, while we've gone from, in the example you gave with the fingerprint cards, we've gone from inked cards to electronic. We increased like 240% in the number coming in. So there's still work to be done with those. The computer doesn't do it all, but it is much more efficient. So part of it is that there's increased productivity, which is good, but that takes a little more time. And then secondly, a number of employees have been retrained to do other things, to handle some of the technology aspects of it. not so much in the integration efforts that Director Johnson was discussing, but our core mission of keeping track of just criminal histories and fingerprints, that's going on all the time. And those, a number of those employees have been retrained to be productive in that area.
Hello, Mr. Chair, Superintendent O'Malley. So is there staffing, can you give me maybe a percentage of increase over those, over the years, or has it stayed neutral, or where have we been at? Maybe 10-year time period.
Mr. Chair and members, I'd have to get back on that, sir. That's all right. I don't know the exact. I would think it's roughly equal, roughly. But I could give you the staffing levels in the Mingus equivalent 10 years ago compared to now, if you'd like.
Maybe you could provide that to the committee at the whole committee at the next meeting.
Okay.
Superintendent, I have a couple questions about the BCA. Thank you for providing the information on the agency-owned vehicles. You should have a memo of that in your packets, I think. So can you just, under BCA, can you just tell us or tell me why when it's other DPS divisions, I guess those are the three there, the other DPS divisions, why there's five vehicles, why in the non-investigative fleet. I'm assuming that's partly training, why we even have 16 vehicles there, and Mingus assigned three vehicles. Maybe you can just explain those three, and then I guess the question is why can't individuals just go and check out their state car rather than having a state car assigned to them?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and members, the five vehicles assigned to other DPS divisions are vehicles that towards the end of their life with us, they're high mileage. There are some other divisions that use vehicles but don't rack up the miles as much or don't use them for police purposes in which there might be high-speed chases or going off-road and that type of thing. So it seemed to be an efficient way for DPS to provide those vehicles.
Are these individual staff members that have cars, or are they just within those divisions?
I'd have to check with the actual divisions, but it's outside of the BCA anyway, those handful.
In the non-investigative fleet, are those individual staff members who have cars, or are those just... Because that's really what I wanted to find out, was who actually was assigned state
right.
cars. I'm not sure if this chief tells us that.
I can explain it, Mr. Chair. It's, where it says fleet, those are not assigned. Those are not individually assigned. The fleet there, when we went from 22 to 16 in the past year, that's entirely the laboratory and Mingus. Mingus has trainers. That's their job. They travel around the state all the time putting on training. So that some of them have the cars that they can check out and use. The laboratory, we have them. We have a handful of very high mileage. I think they're the Prius hybrids, if I remember. But we have a handful of those that are used by laboratory scientists when they travel around the state to testify or to go to meetings for preparing for prosecuting cases. They have to travel to different courthouses.
Maybe I didn't make my questions clear the last time we talked about cars, but I was trying to find out how many cars of the 132 vehicles are actually assigned to people who actually have a state car. I'm assuming you have a state car.
Mr. Chair, I do. The first line where it says special agents investigations, that those are all assigned. Investigation fleets are not. Mingus assigned. There are three assigned there. And those are the out-state trainers who leave their home and go to different locations to train. Lab assigned is one, and that's the director of the lab, primarily because that is, while the frequency isn't a lot, although it happens several times a year, alarms will go off for the freezers or the humidity in certain areas of the lab, and my access card doesn't get me in the lab, and honestly, I don't want to have access to the lab. There's the accreditation we talked about, both the legal and the practical scientific aspects of having limited access to that. So we have very, very tight controls on that. And then the crime scene, they're not assigned. Those are the two crime scene vehicles, one in Bemidji and one in the Twin Cities.
And the special agents the 66 special agents, are those also training officers or agents, or are those all BCA agents that go out on investigations?
Mr. Chair, those are all the BCA agents. We do not have agents right now specifically assigned to training exclusively. All of our agents are assigned within an investigative division. That was a change within the last year. The ones that I have expertise in training do a fair amount of training, but they are assigned in an investigative division, for example, in narcotics, where they will be on surveillance or search warrants or do other things.
So you don't have a training division anymore?
Mr. Chair, we do have a training division, but we have reorganized that in the last year, again, towards efficiencies. We used to have three divisions within the BCA that all had training components: the laboratory, ninjas, and investigations. We reorganized that to take all the administrative functions away from those individual sections. So now we have one unit that handles all the marketing, the reserving of rooms, the supplies, all that for efficiency purposes, and left the subject matter experts in each of those divisions. So while at one time there were agents assigned to training and that was their job, they would still occasionally go out on investigations. When Katie Porter gets taken, we send everybody. Everybody is available. But now, no agents are specifically assigned to training where that's their duty. Instead, they're on the street doing things, and they don't spend any time on these administrative functions. They may train a class now and then, and more importantly, they will come up with what the latest needs are in their area of expertise and make sure that our training matches that.
Superintendent, I'm going to question, and I don't know if the commissioner wants to chime in here, but on page 52 of our budget book, it's the criminal apprehension support, and it talks about the activity description, the senior management, human resources, etc., communications, and then many of the human resources and communications also shows up on page 19 of the budget book. I'm just wondering if you've looked at consolidation of, I guess for lack of a better word, your management structure, rather than having, if I'm reading this correctly, it looks like there's two separate management entities. Am I reading it incorrectly?
Yes.
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is a little bit confusing. Within the Commissioner's office, we have an Office of Communications. The total amount of general funds devoted toward that Office of Communications is $43,000. The rest of the funding for the Office of Communications comes from various federal programs that we have that have specific money designated towards communications and media activities. Then with on page 52, what you're seeing there is when we have a director of communications, but when we have a lot of activity and a lot of media calls, obviously related to the State Patrol and related to BCA. So we do have subject matter expertise both within the Minnesota State Patrol and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension that do routinely answer communications and media calls. But that is coordinated with our Office of Communications.
And the human resources component?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is also true. They work as liaisons to the main human resources area within public safety. BCA is located in a separate facility, mm-hmm. and each one of our divisions has personnel expediters, people that do the payroll and all of that, and that, of course, is even more significant to a location that's off-site.
And Deputy Commissioner, as long as you're answering these questions, then it's a little problematic for, especially in this time. I mean, normally I probably would zip by some of these pages in the budget book, but I obviously, with the deficit, I think we have to look more closely. And I will be asking and writing for some more information about the administrative and related services. I talked to Chair Leader about this because we have had sort of an odd situation here where we have part of public safety and transportation as part of public safety, but we really never look, there's no way really to look into administrative and related services here because of that division. So we'll be asking for some more information. But I, like, in terms of your lobbying activity, your staff, like Mr. Jordahl is your lobbyist for DPS, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, he's director of Government Affairs and Strategic Planning. So he does both the legislative work and strategic planning for the agency as a whole.
Would that be on our DCS side, or would that be on both DCS, on the transportation end of it too?
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, he worked across the whole agency.
And then Mr. Shields, who came to talk to me about an issue, is he on the BCA crime prevention side, or is he on a different side? Or is he a contract employee, or is he a full-time employee?
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, he is a Rule 10 employee.
What is that?
Which means he's an at-will employee, or he's hired on a temporary basis for a limited amount of time. He is assigned a special project. When he was working on a project related to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, he was paid from the criminal apprehension budget. Now he is working for the Emergency Communications Network, so then he's paid out of that budget. So he is paid according to the project that he is assigned to complete.
And that general fund money?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, I'd have to check to be sure, but I believe it probably is.
Could you let me know that? And then I'm sorry, members, I did not give you this report, but I'll make copies of it. But I'm just wondering what you're doing to reduce the overtime pay. It seems high to me, and I could be off on that, and there could be some perfectly legitimate explanations for it. But Commissioner, do you have a sense of why those numbers are so high? And I'm assuming this is costing the DPS a lot of money.
Mr. Chair, are you referring to overtime for agents?
Yes.
I'll let Mr. O'Malley.
Well, I think it's overtime. Yeah, BCA. Throughout the BCA.
I'll let Mr. O'Malley answer.
Superintendent?
Mr. Chair, members, we have an overtime account, and agents are on call for the crime scene team, for example, in which contractually we're required to pay them for being on call for that. As far as other overtime paid to agents, there are times when it is essential that they be available and go out. They're not paid to be on call, if you will, other than just a few that are on the crime scene team. It seems each time we have one of these hearings, something horrendous in the state has happened in a few days before that. And this time it was the abduction of the 17-year-old girl at midnight Saturday night. When that happened, we had 10 agents go up there within an hour. They're not on call. But when a local law enforcement agency who may face that crime once in 50 years, and we have some level of expertise either in terms of approaches or equipment, it is critical that we get that up there right away. And that's the kind of event that would result in overtime. Our investigations are not 8 to 5.
I understood. I'm just trying to get from you, do you think that's a number you should be working on? Or do you think that's just what would be normal on an annual activities of the BCA investigating crime scenes?
Mr. Chairman, members, we have looked at that real hard over each year, and we end up using a fair amount of some forfeited money and some other funds in order to do that, or some federal grants in order to pay that overtime. We examine that. We make sure that agents are accountable for that time very closely. I think it is money well spent in order to be able to respond to the situations around the state.
Mr. Chair, let me answer quick, add something to that. FSLA, the Federal Standards or Labor Act, deems criminal investigators as hourly employees. They're not salaried employees, so they are compensated by the hour. There isn't a criminal investigative person in the world that doesn't accrue overtime. I think the BCA a long time ago crafted a balance of compensatory time and paid overtime that balances it pretty well, and not every hour of overtime work is compensated financially. I wouldn't say forced, but the system allows or mandates that they take compensatory time off, which doesn't cost the state any money. So there really is a very reasonable balance there, and it's compared to other investigative agencies, I think it's been a pretty balanced, and I wouldn't call it frugal, but a very balanced approach to compensation for overtime.
Well, let me just tell you what like a regular citizen might think, and not necessarily with the BCA, but when you see a news report saying that Minneapolis police officers are making $160,000 a year with their overtime, you know, the average citizen's saying, what? Now, I don't know if that's with the BCA, but I think it's, I, you know.
Mr. Chair, one other...
The public is sort of watching everything we're doing now as they should, and I'm just trying to figure out ways that we can reduce costs.
To add on to what the Commissioner mentioned, we also, under FLSA, we have the option of determining the amount of overtime that needs to be compensated, whether with time off or cash, on either an 8-hour day, 40-hour week, 80-hour, or in our case, we go to a 28-day cycle. So over that 28 days, agents can work up to 171 hours at straight time. It's not until you break 171 that it starts being compensated or added up as time and a half. So that gives our supervisors some flexibility. When this happened over the weekend and some agents went up there and maybe they worked 15 hours or whatever it might be, within the 28 days we can look at that and we can determine, all right, here's the kinds of cases you're working on. And I've had it happen. In fact, I can tell you specifically when Katie Poyer was taken, we had agents leave a training session, and I called one of them and said, no, go back to the training session. Your comp time is too high. You're not going over there. We have enough agents now. So we look at that for every situation that happens and make sure that if their comp time is high, we keep it at a level where they're compensated at a reasonable amount.
Representative Haas and Cornish.
Thank you very much. I was wondering on the overtime and keeping the balance between overtime and compensatory time. Is part of this caused by the shortage of employees, or is it just natural to the system?
Superintendent?
Mr. Chair, members, I think it's probably a little bit of both. When our agent numbers are down, the comp time will go up slightly, and we just have to manage it, and there's maybe fewer types of cases that we can work, if you will. We leave more to the local law enforcement. So it's a little bit of each.
Mr. Chair, let me attempt to answer another feature to that. If a Minneapolis police officer gets called to work overtime, they go to the city of Minneapolis, and they probably live within driving distance, 10, 15 minutes, maybe half an hour, maybe at the most an hour. The situation over the weekend in Fergus Falls, there was probably two agents in Alexandria. The other eight agents had to drive 3 or 4 hours from some other location. So the driving distance for most of the work that the investigators at the BCA do is complicated by the fact that it's not in their hometown or where they live. They generally, particularly in an event like that, have to drive a distance to get to the event. So that adds, I think, it's understandable, adds some additional time to the investigative effort.
Mr. McClanis?
Mr. Chair and members, just for some background information, I used to sit on the negotiating team for the union to negotiate against these folks for the union side. And they are very stingy with overtime. And in fact, when they take comp time, they really don't want to, the agents, because there's a workload that they would like to be doing. They're so dedicated. They don't want to take the comp time, but have to because of the situation where the overtime is. So they actually beg for overtime at just about every negotiating session. And so it's a constant budget battle back there. So they're pretty stingy.
Representative Kelly?
Mr. Chair, just a question to clarify. Did you say there are contractors that we do pay to be on call? Just to be on call?
Superintendent?
Mr. Chairman, members, yes. For the crime scene team, because they need to be, under the contract, they need to be within an hour of work. They need to be stone sober. They need to be ready to go for that whole time. When something happens in a different part of the state, like what happened over the weekend, it would be financially very difficult to put every agent on call and have to compensate. But because for this specific thing, we can expect there'll probably be a crime scene. You know, we have 80-some a year. There's probably going to be one this week. And we want you to be ready to go and have all your equipment and a level of expertise.
Mr. Chair, also, that's an FSLA requirement. If you're on call, you have to be compensated. There is no... It isn't a contract unique to the BCA or these individual people. It's an FSLA requirement.
Mr. Chair, thank you. That's the clarification. I was just curious what the need was and how that contract works. And do you know how much of the percentage, say, of the overtime that we're paying? Or
Superintendent.
Mr. Chair, members, let me just clarify. Are you talking about whether these are contract employees or state employees under the labor contract?
Well,
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You just made the statement that we were paying for some services or paying for contract employees to be on call, and that's where my question was.
Mr. Chair, members, these are BCA agents under the contract that the other representative was talking about there. These are not contract employees. These are not in, it's not that situation.
Commissioner, just final question here. We requested of you, and you should have it in your packets, members. The question that we asked of you was that we asked you to submit a realistic budget proposal for both a 5% and a 10% reduction. Do you want to respond to what you provided, Commissioner?
We gave them both of them, right?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
the
memo that I have from Melanie McMahon asked to provide realistic budget proposals for both a 5% and a 10% reduction. Please presume that, and we're asked to describe what that would look like. And so what we provided was a sheet that lists the numbers for a 5% and a 10% reduction. What I would say in terms of what a realistic budget would be, and then I'll ask the commissioner to make some statements. 29% of our overall budget is general fund, and of that 25% overall agency budget that's general fund, 89% of that, or 86%, is either within the Office of Justice Programs or the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. So you see the actual numbers here for a 5% or 10% cut, but what it would look like really would determine how the committee would direct us to take the cut. So if we had to take it across the board, we would simply reduce everybody by either 5% or 10%, and that would mean reductions in services for primarily crime victim services in the Office of Justice Program, law enforcement and community grants would be reduced. And then within the BCA, of course, we'd be looking at reducing agent time, lab time, training for law enforcement officers across the state. So, again, it depends upon where we would be directed to specifically take those budget cuts, but if we're talking about general fund, most of the money is either within the Office of Justice Program or the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension.
So if I understand, Deputy Commissioner, so what you basically did is you just cut 5%, 10% across. I mean, you just made, I mean, there was no thought, you didn't prioritize. That was what the hope, I think, what we were trying to get at is if you had to make a 5% cut, if you could give us direction rather than just cutting straight 5% and 10%, we could have done that or had an intern do that or something. I mean, it's not very helpful. I understand the position that you're in, Commissioner, and you've got the governor's budget going, and believe me, there's not any member here that doesn't want the governor's budget to actually prevail. In terms of the Department of Corrections and DPS. In fact, I hope that when leadership gives us our target, that the Department of Human Rights is held harmless also. But I just don't know that that's going to happen. So I guess I'm trying to build a way that we're going to have a process in light of the fact that we may have some cuts here and how we can work together to make if that indeed becomes a reality.
Mr. Chair, your comments are, I think, are sincere, and I think we take them very seriously. I mean, these are awfully, as you know, and everybody in the committee knows, these are very difficult decisions to make, and when we have to make our cuts, they're going to be difficult for everybody involved, and certainly difficult for the people that we represent, the stakeholders that we try to work with all the time. We had prioritized one thing, whether it's on the documents provided or not. I think one thing that we won't cut are at the BCA or laboratory scientists. The rest of public safety, the general fund money comes out of agents and crime victims programs. So for us to really lay in front of you what we would specifically do in crime victim programs and at other programs at the BCA in terms of cuts, I don't know that we're prepared to do that right now, but I would tell you, in terms of priority, we wouldn't. We would hold the forensic science laboratories harmless because of the significant impact that it does have on the criminal justice system. As has been described, it really is the bottleneck of the criminal justice system. Everything stops when forensic science isn't analyzed, and so we would hold that as a real priority. The other ones, as time goes on, Mr. Chair, we'll certainly work with you, but and that's as good as we could come up with right now.
We have a couple questions, and then we need to adjourn. Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate you raising that point. As I looked at the documents that we've been given, it was very hard for me to find where our priorities. And I think, Commissioner and Superintendent, we need that. You know, we're not the ones doing it on a daily basis, but we're going to have to help provide some direction. And especially as a new member of the committee, as I just looked at straight cuts, it doesn't tell me what the priorities are. So I thank you, Mr. Chair, for raising that.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair, but I think you and Representative Reiner had already covered what I want.
Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is a question for you. Last week with the Department of Corrections, you had a list of kind of the administration or the employees and kind of the pay scale, and you had a bunch of information on that. Did you or Ms. McMahon ask that of every department to set a curiosity?
We're going to, that's why I mentioned that earlier. Representative Leader and I are going to submit something in writing to the commissioner so we can get, because of the shared jurisdictional issue,
okay.
I wanted Representative Leader to be involved in that.
And then I just had one follow-up for the testifier. So, Commissioner Campion, as I just heard you say that the only priority you have as far as the thing that you're going to hold harmless is the BCA. So everything else is fair game if you are asked to cut. Is that what you said?
Mr. Chair, no, I don't think that's what I said. I think what I said is that in the areas that are funded with general fund money, the forensic scientists at the BCA would be the ones that I think we've decided to hold harmless because of the importance and the impact, the negative impact on the criminal justice system if, in fact, we cut scientists. That doesn't mean that other areas at the BCA, and as is documented on the sheets in front of you, crime victims and other activities that are funded with general fund, to include other areas of the BCA, we just haven't made a decision on those things at all yet.
And you were asked to make a decision on those by the chair? I'm just wondering. You were asked to prioritize.
I think we were asked to illustrate what 5 and 10% would look like.
Bigham, we asked for a realistic budget proposal, and I'm not sure how realistic these are, but I guess at this stage of the game, so this will have to suffice, and we'll see what happens. Superintendent, Deputy Commissioner, Commissioner, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you,
members. This meeting's adjourned.